You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 24th, 2020. I'm Matt Leck on a Matt, Brendan, Jamie, and Matt Thursday on the five-time award-winning Majority Report, broadcasting closer than ever to the industry-ravaged Gowanus Canal, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, a throwback Michael interview from October 2016 with then-Jacobin editor Peter Fraze on his book Four Futures, Life After Capitalism. Also on the program, Trump. Donald Trump declines to commit to a peaceful transition of power, saying, get rid of the ballots, and we'll have a peaceful continuation. Donald Trump also stated he was prepared to send federal law enforcement to crack down on protests in Louisville, Kentucky on Wednesday night, after two police officers were shot during the unrest over a grand jury's decision not to indict the officers involved in Breonna Taylor's shooting for her death. Also, President Trump on Wednesday said a plan by the Food and Drug Administration to issue tough new standards for emergency approval of coronavirus vaccine sounds like a political move, and warned that the White House might reject it. Also, Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody on Wednesday called for an investigation into an effort by Mike Bloomberg to help restore voting rights of thousands of felons ahead of the November election. Florida disenfranchises felons for a reason, the Republicans are saying. Ex-felons, I should say. Also, the U.S. no longer recognizes Alexander Lukashenko as the legitimate president of Belarus, the State Department said on Wednesday. And in some on-balance positive news, aspirational news, the world's fifth largest economy, California, and the state that created car culture, this piece says, will stop selling gasoline-powered automobiles within 15 years, Governor Gavin Newsom announced. All that and more on today's Majority Report. So, folks, not looking super great lately, I must say. I don't know. Brendan, how are you holding up?
I'm doing all right. I saw the protests across the Manhattan Bridge last evening. It was a little bit of a positive note. Went very well. Otherwise, you know, we're dealing with the possibility of a sitting president just capturing elections through the courts and everyone in his party helping to enable that.
Yeah, I think that's the play here, is they're either going for and setting themselves up to try a 2000 Bush versus Gore, which, you know, happened in 2000 when, guess what, they haven't got more shame since then. Or I think it was Ryan Grimm tweeted out that talking about just stealing the election is good for depressing turnout. So folks, we need to, if they're going to steal it, we need to make them steal it. We can't let them win by just talking about how they're going to steal it. And they might not actually have the ability to. I mean, Trump obviously, I think, wants to. If he had his desires to, like, we wouldn't even be doing voting this November. But yeah, it's a horrific time. I mean, I'm brought back to, like, shortly after the election when I used to get very morbid around like 11 p.m. at night, thinking like, oh, this is actually it. And turns out like that feeling wasn't entirely or even largely incorrect. But anyway, speaking of futures, let's talk about the interview for today. We've got Michael Brooks talking with Peter Fraze, or Frazee, I think it's Peter Fraze, on his book, The Four Futures. And it's basically different, using science fiction to explore different routes this can go. This can go very good in a certain quadrant where we have abundance and equality, or it could go really bad where we have, you know, eco-fascism. And I think I picked this interview because this is one that Michael actually mentioned fairly regularly we had it. And it also reminds me of back in October 2016. This is the first time Jacobin was sort of coming into focus in terms of what they do. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed this interview, and We will see you with Matt Binder and Jamie Peck on the other side of this. Also, join themajorityreport.com, become a member, support what we're doing here. We really appreciate it. And again, see you on the other side of this interview.
All right, welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Peter Fraes. He's an editor at the Jacobin Magazine and author of The Four Futures, Life After Capitalism. Peter, how you doing?
Great to be here again.
Yeah, it's really good to be speaking with you again. I really, really enjoyed the initial article in the Jacobin that sort of inspired the book, and I just finished reading a copy of the book that came out just recently on Verso, and it's fascinating. You outline four scenarios for where we could go in a post-capital world. I want you to get to those four scenarios, but to get there, I want you to explain how you use science fiction and that type of literature and pop culture reference in this book. It's an area that I'll admit it's a genre that I'm not very familiar with at all. So I kind of opened it up with not skepticism, but a sort of lack of familiarity. So I didn't really see how it was going to play into the arguments, but you synchronized it really well with the four scenarios that you outlined. So talk about the use of those texts, those pieces of pop culture, and then use that as a doorway to get us into the four post-capitalist scenarios you see.
Sure. So the use of science fiction, I mean, I've always read a lot of speculative fiction. And then it sort of fit into this book because I was trying to write something that wasn't just talking about the immediate political tasks going forward, but to try to think a little farther into the future about really different kinds of societies than one that we live in. But the problem that poses is that, like a lot of people on the left, I try to avoid just writing blueprints for the future. You know, mm-hmm. Karl Marx had a line where he said you shouldn't write recipes for the kitchens of the future. In part because they almost never turn out the way you expect, but also because if you really believe, as I do, that a new kind of future society has to be democratically made by the masses of people that will bring it into being, that's not consistent with thinking you know exactly how it's going to play out in
advance. Actually, Peter, could you elaborate on that, just to take a side tangent for a second? Because I still think in popular culture and pop intellectual culture, particularly in the United States, there's still this notion very much, and obviously some of it is rooted in a, you know, historical examples of, you know, Soviet abuse and totalitarianism or purges in China or, you know, places where governments with that mantle of a kind of, you know, a communist mantle have sort of had very strict linear plans and egregiously violated human rights. So there's still this popular conception that the left is like this sort of ultimate maker of clear blueprints. But when you actually get into the literature and the actual argumentation, it's quite the opposite. So I'd love it if you could take just a brief side tangent and elaborate on that. That would be great.
Sure. I mean, there certainly have been and still are, you know, people who do sort of write blueprints and want to sketch out in detail what the new society would look like. And there are some people that will say, well, you can't criticize capitalism unless you can tell me exactly what will replace it.
Right.
But for me, it's much more helpful to start by identifying key features of the present that I think that I don't like, that I think impede human freedom and human flourishing, and think about how we might move beyond those and then where that might lead. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my starting point in the book is specifically the institution of wage labor, the fact that so many of us spend so much of our time in the essentially unfree condition of having sold our time to a boss who tells us what to do. And one of the dreams of the socialist movement and the left more broadly has always been to minimize and ultimately, if possible, completely overcome that kind of labor and that kind of unfreedom. And so I start with that in the book in combination with, you know, these conversations that have started to pop up again recently about automation, robots,
right,
computers, algorithms, all these ways of replacing human labor, and then saying, okay, well, if that's possible, if we have these technologies, what are the possibilities in terms of either making us more free or not?
Right. So that's where you sort of get, and I guess we can keep sort of, you can reference the science fiction literature and everything else as we sort of delineate these categories, because you basically outline, you identify the two sort of foundational crises of our time in the climate crisis and inequality as these sort of defining overarching issues, the sort of organizing problems or challenges we face in a certain sense. I'm not sure that's how you put it, but these sort of fundamental backdrops. Then you say we have there's abundance futures and scarcity futures, and then two different versions of each. Can you explain the sort of outlines of those four futures and how they're sort of mirrored in the speculative fiction you mentioned before?
Sure. So, again, starting with this sort of premise of what if we could kind of automate everything, what if it were possible to escape from labor? And that's complicated in terms of what I actually think about that debate, but I sort of use it as a premise to get into the more science fictional stuff.
Right.
And then I say, yeah, there's these two parameters. There's this 2x2 grid, this box that I draw. You have that ecology axis that is either on the scarcity side or the abundance side, which means do we actually get to renewable energy, find ways to mitigate climate change, find ways to, you know, better produce and recycle and so on, so that we can, you know, actually have a sort of a truly post-scarcity life. Whereas the other option is, even if you have the machines that can produce with no labor at the push of a button, we don't have infinite resources to feed that. And so then the politics becomes much more about making sure that each of us gets shared out equally as much as we can have, given the ecological constraint. And so that's the one axis. Then the other axis is the political one, or as I sometimes say, the class struggle axis.
Mm-hmm.
With, on one end, equality, the historic dream of the left of, you know, as much as possible, equality of condition between people. And at the other end, hierarchy, what we have now, the 1% or the 0.01% versus the rest, and where resources and power are monopolized by a tiny elite. And it's in the interaction between those axes that you get the four different sort of stylized futures. So to start in the most utopian square, if you have abundance and you have equality, you have what I call communism, in the sense of the sort of old Marxist idea that in true communism with a small c, it's from each according to her ability to each according to his need. We are not compelled to do anything other than the free development of our own talents, right? And so this is where these sort of science fiction futures where, you know, 3D printers turn into things like the Star Trek replicator, and we have nanobots, and we have all these ways where basically we, you know, we sort of develop our collective projects not on the basis of money in the way that we see fit. And people who look around today and see things like, you know, open source software, Wikipedia, you know, various kind of collectives, you know, producing whatever it is, community gardens or whatever, and say these are little pockets of communism in our world. And so that chapter is looking at what is it like if you blow those up, and where are the kind of conflicts and contradictions of that, which are no longer about capitalism, but it doesn't mean that there aren't sort of hierarchies and conflicts that arise in that scenario.
Actually, Peter, that's another thing I'd like you to go off on that tangent as well. Another really interesting thing that you raise in this book, and you use, again, you use fiction skillfully to illustrate the point, is another sort of generic thing that you will hear about, you know, I mean, you know, in some ways, even these sort of, even these frames around any of these systems are kind of silly in a certain way. But one of these things that you'll hear is like, you know, well, communism will never work because, you know, we know such and such a thing about human nature, which is, you know, I mean, you can, in some way, you could just, as you know, you could say capitalism will never work because we know such and such a thing about human nature. I mean, these are very kind of metaphysical comments. They're not really grounded. But one of the points that statement sort of directs us to, which is legitimate and you deal with, is that even if you escape and or redesign a process away from money or labor exchange, there's still hierarchies, there's still social competition that it will manifest in different ways. So the question is more, can these things be, at least this is how I read it, are there ways of setting up institutions where, you know, we recognize legitimate hierarchies all the time, right? Like if we had this functioning, you know, Star Trek great abundant, sort of more equal society, it wouldn't mean that we were all physicians, because some people still have those skills and others don't, right? And so that's like kind of, you could say that's a natural hierarchy. There still will be, in an open culture, debates and conflict around politics and ideas. So anyways, I'd like you to just get into that just because these sort of particular types of very zero-sum competition have been taken away does not mean that it's sort of like a bland, faceless mass that doesn't have natural hierarchies or just natural human conflict.
Yeah. So the way I sort of put it is, a lot of times when you call yourself socialist, or people will say, oh, but you mean that you just mean capitalism causes all the problems, right? We get rid of capitalism, we get rid of all the problems. But right. That's not what I think.
Right.
The metaphor I use in the book is the metaphor of the capital relation between capital and labor as like a magnet. Mm-hmm. Those are like the two poles of a magnet. And it produces a magnetic field that tends to draw other conflicts and other hierarchies toward it, right? Which doesn't mean that, say, sexism is totally reducible to capitalism, but that it tends to be moved into alignment with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is with all these other conflicts. And it's that that makes the stakes so high in all of them, because they all come back to that basic conflict of how do we make a living? How do we survive? And so part of what makes me sort of hopeful, but even though I'm trying to be realistic about the kinds of conflicts that arise in a post-scarcity society, is that they're more sort of fragmented, and therefore it's possible to sort of opt out of situations in a way that it isn't often in a capitalist society.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it more possible to really deal with some of this stuff and overcome things that just seem like intractable problems of the human condition under capitalism. But at the same time, I always like to say new problems we can't even imagine will arise. It's project of overcoming capitalism is for me a project of finding new and better human problems.
Right. I think there's an old, I forget who said it, but something to the effect of the goal of society should be to sort of move people out of relentless, brutal, oppressive misery so they can go and have productive, healthy suffering. Which is
my friend Corey Robin, the political scientist, has a line like that that I think he sort of draws from Freud, which is, it's the project of going from hysterical misery to ordinary unhappiness.
Right. And there's a lot more kind of human productivity in wrestling with that unhappiness. So, okay. So we have this scenario where we've created some type of, and to be really specific, when you talk about that abundance, you're talking about things like the possibilities of 3D printing. You're talking about, on one hand, that those two sort of poles, because the other paradox is that in the information economy, scarcity is sort of completely artificially created. And then on the other hand, that would be great for you to elaborate on, and as you get into some of the bad scenarios. And then on the other hand, where scarcity is, not at all artificially created. It's quite literally like we are destroying at a sort of just amazing pace the basics of the Earth's functional systems. In the abundance ideal scenario, we figured out a fusion where it's the 3D printers run on wind power, run on solar, and we have sort of come up with that fusion and it's run sort of equitably. Now, move into the first scenario of we've generated abundance, but we still have artificial scarcity in the information economy, and we have to generate and sustain a lack of equality in terms of access, which is in many ways the world that we're seeing enacted very much day to day now.
Yeah. And that's also part of a point I would make about the book in general. Each future is supposed to isolate something that is happening right now.
Right.
And kind of, in the way it's often said, science fiction is always really about the time in which it's written.
Mm-hmm.
And so these futures are just sort of in concentrated form issues in the present. So in the case of what you're talking about, this is actually where this whole project started for me, was that question of artificial scarcity and how class power is sort of maintained in the potentially abundant future.
Mm-hmm.
And it was started with, I was considering the Star Trek TV show where they have you know, they are in a communist society, basically, as far as I am concerned. They have their replicators. They have their magical antimatter generators. They can get in spaceships and fly around in a military hierarchy if they feel like it, apparently, but I don't get the sense that anybody's really required to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then I sort of think, okay, well, what if it wasn't a communist society? What if the technology were the same, but the class structures were totally different? They were more like our world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what led me to this question of, okay, you don't need human labor to produce anymore. You have these replicators. How does the ruling class stay the ruling class? And it's through these forms of artificial scarcity and forms of property that take the form of rent. So this rentism is the name I use for this regime. Right, because rent we think of traditionally in terms of things like land, where you don't produce anything. It's just if you own the land, you can charge for access to it.
Right.
If you own the apartment, you can charge for access to it, whether or not you're actually like putting anything into it, as opposed to actually like producing a product and selling it.
Right.
But that form of property extends far beyond land, especially now, and intellectual property has the same form. You own the rights to copy, you know, the digital file of a movie. It doesn't actually cost anything or almost anything to do that. It's just there's a legal property form that says I can't copy that without paying the fee.
Right.
And likewise, it doesn't matter how little it might cost to produce a life-saving medicine, the company that owns the patent decides what the price of it is.
Right.
And so the thought experiment in that part of the, you know, that corner of the four futures is how what happens is that kind of blows up to become more and more of the economy. What happens in a world where essentially, as I, you know, there's a Charles Strauss novel that I open that chapter with that opens with the main character sort of on the run from the copyright police.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's where I take that chapter, the kind of the forms of the legal forms and the economic forms that would be necessary and what the contradictions would be of an economy like that.
Right. So that's and we can see that's the sort of core contradiction. Those sort of two contradictions are where they're sort of the most explosive things we're dealing with, because on one hand we're developing this hyper information economy where things like all of a sudden now, you know, even something like a replicator like thing in Star Trek every day seems less and less, you know, implausible, even relative to like, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, or certainly, I mean, even if you were watching it and you were, you know, I don't know, 6 or 7 when the latest version of Star Trek came out, that Next Generation show. And then, again, conversely, we're building that on top of a completely collapsing basic ecological infrastructure, the scale of the crisis of which we're, you know, barely at best beginning to address. And then in that information area, we're again, as you say, we're creating this entirely artificial means of scarcity just to justify having a monetized system around it, which is not even sort of logical to its development, because a lot of these technologies and programs and initial developments came out of, again, more of that sort of open or a culture, or if you want to say communistic sort of space. Then you have scenarios where you're sort of saying we haven't, I'm not sure I'm reading this right, but it's like we haven't quite dealt with the ecological crisis, or our lives are just increasingly defined by material scarcity of the world because we have not been able to reverse those crises. We haven't been able to regenerate things. We haven't. And then again, you have two scenarios, which is we've sort of figured out and evolved our politics, so the consequences of that are far less brutal. And then we have another scenario where we are living in this, you know, almost like children of men like future, which is the best I can do for a speculative fiction reference, my friend.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I mean, that's not a bad one. So, right. So the simplest way I would put this scarcity end of the table that I'm talking about here is basically we have the replicators and everything.
Right.
But the carbon cost of the replicators, or the amount of, you know, rare materials that they require, means that you can't just replicate whatever you want whenever you want. Somebody has to decide who gets to make what.
Right.
So, and that brings me to a couple of questions that animate the sort of scarcity with equality box that I draw, which is, you know, this is where the relationship between socialism and ecology comes to the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about, you know, my view on sort of environmentalism being that we have to be very real about the fact that dealing with the crisis that that capitalism has created is going to mean an even deeper involvement with sort of managing nature and becoming involved with us sort of continuing to remake the earth in order that it can support us. And then I talk a little bit about.
So that's like a big objection to like a Derek Jensen style sort of step back from the earth and kind of fold into the woodwork and let it do its thing, like a sort of neo-romanticism. Is that what you're objecting to?
Even among people that aren't really hardcore primitivists or deep ecologists, you still get it in the rhetoric a lot. You know, we talk about we need to lighten our carbon footprint, mm-hmm. as though the problem is that, you know, is that humans are separate from nature, and that the problem is that we're mucking with it too much, when the problem is actually that we are completely a part of nature, and that's why we have to accept that and accept that we are the only species that has the potential capability to address this crisis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it gets me that, yeah, so it means, and what that means in terms of like how ambitious we become, in terms of trying to manipulate the climate, for example, is something I'm still wrestling with and researching, but it's something that I want to sort of open the space for. But then I also, in that same chapter, want to talk about these old kind of issues of like what a socialist economy looks like, what the role of planning versus markets look like,
mm-hmm.
And to try to suggest that a lot of the problems that arose in those discussions in the 20th century had to do with the relationship to production and labor.
Mm-hmm.
Who decides what gets produced? Who decides the division of labor? But that if you think of these of planning schemes or market schemes more in terms of planning consumption, of this question of we can't all replicate whatever we want, different people want different things, how do we decide, you know, how much of what gets made? That there's ways to do that with some combination of democratic planning and market mechanisms,
mm-hmm.
that would not, if it was happening outside of a capitalist context, wouldn't have the negative features that we associate either with economic planning or with markets.
So that's really like just seriously updated. But in, as an example, again, just pointing with the argument of the book that you're isolating worlds that exist now. And that's the world that seems to me just like a really updated, rigorous social democracy, a bit more like we do already see in some Scandinavian countries to some extent.
Yeah, I think that's right, especially now that some of them are starting to move in the direction of being less sort of work-focused. You know, you have things like the universal basic income being right. seriously discussed among social democrats. And so to the extent that that part of social democracy starts to evolve in a more post-war direction, then, yeah, what you have left are these sort of questions of ecological and economic management, I think.
And again, also the lifestyle questions too, because then it's like the other thing that like and part of the foundation of the book that if we're supposedly moving into this post-work world, that could either be mass wasted human life, or it could be a complete sort of burgeoning and opening of compensated social capital and society building, where all sorts of talents and abilities to, you know, educate people, create projects, you know, all of the rest could be sort of all of this sort of rhetoric and energy of entrepreneurship and social innovation that's sort of very narrowly funneled through like a venture capital lens or a really tight philanthropic lens could get massively opened up and just sort of invested in as an arm of just broad mass social innovation and government investment.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah, part of the argument that needs to be made is that there's a tremendous human potential that you unlock when you give people both the time and the sort of skills and resources to really pursue their passion, not in that cynical sense of passion means you work for me and I don't have to pay you, but in like we actually have the freedom to build the projects that we want. Because, yeah, otherwise you get into the last sort of square of my 2x2, the world in which, you know, the existence of ecological limits means that the sort of rentist future of absurd intellectual property doesn't quite work because the ruling class has to reduce its own standard of living in order to supply all of these other people that it wants to exploit.
Right.
So the alternative vision is, yeah, you said Children of Men, I sort of used the film Elysium at the start of that chapter to talk a little bit about it. A world in which the, you know, I talk about the dangers, the great danger of the moment we're in, one of them anyway, is that historically the a capitalist economy has been characterized by a relationship of mutual dependence between the boss and the worker.
Right.
In the sense that the worker needs a job, doesn't have any other way to earn the means of subsistence, and so needs the capitalist. And the capitalist needs the worker to make, run the factories, to run the shops, and all of that. But if human labor is eliminated or massively reduced in the system, what that breaks that dependence, and it creates a situation in which the rich don't need us anymore. They have their robots, they have their replicators, and we are just surplus populations to them.
Right. Right.
And that leads to people are warehoused in prisons, people are warehoused in refugee camps. You know, people are allowed to die of preventable diseases or die in natural disasters caused by climate change.
So like the Republican platform, basically.
What's that?
Like the Republican platform, essentially.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Trump is, you know, Trump is more of a rentier guy, but they're ready to veer in the other direction if necessary.
Yeah, no, I mean, maybe more. I actually am thinking of Paul Ryan more than Trump. I mean,
Ted Cruz was the ultimate exterminist candidate to me.
Right, 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 right. That makes total sense. And in all senses. If we were going to take this down to the sort of, you know, and I don't want to sort of operationalize this conversation too much or try to make it too practical, because I don't think that that's really the point of this argument in some respects and this reading. I think it just is a brilliant way of enlarging the scope and understanding of what's happening in our world now and where we could be heading. And in fact, again, in actually a grounded and non-cynical sense, the notion that we do actually have some ability and some power to sort of shape the reality of our world and where it's going. But if we were going to take it into the realm of like, and I don't think these are mutually exclusive, but do you see like, okay, so there are these four pressure points that we can see where like, okay, there's work and create these projects that sort of model the world we want, or at least a much bigger part of the world than exists now. And that's the space of, you know, starting a worker-run business, create a community-generated garden, invest in parts of the information economy that are run on commons. Then there's, you know, I guess in the rent piece, you know, build movements, push reformist policies on rent affordability, increasing wages, and then connected with that, really aggressively safeguard the remnants of social democracy that we have now, and then push like, you know, the Bernie agenda. And then in the fourth point, it seems like that's an area where there's a lot of just sort of burgeoning work and a lot of just sort of direct action and conflict on, you know, serious human rights advocacy, whether it's Black Lives Matter or, you know, objecting to the, you know, mass sort of abuse of refugees and migrants across the globe. I mean, I'm just wondering, like, where are the pressure points and points of entry to start sort of directing things from this framework where we want them to go?
I mean, I think you sort of identified the key strands of movements that are already happening, right? That these kind of commons-based projects are happening, environmental justice movements are happening, movements against militarism both at home and abroad are happening, movements for freedom of access to information or for access to medicines in poor countries and so on are happening. And I don't pretend to sort of be the master strategist for any of these movements. They'll continue to happen both independently and interactingly. I guess part of, though, the vision for me is, you know, in the wake of Bernie Sanders in the United States, we have all these people who are coming and, you know, calling themselves socialists for the first time, who find that like idea of that as an of the idea of a broad alternative to our system compelling. We don't necessarily have a good sense of what exactly that means. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it excites me that we have this going on. I've been a socialist for 20 years, but I think I'm hopeful that I can take some of the stuff that I've thought about this over the years and try to draw a picture that says, how do all these things sort of fit together into a broader vision of what the main problems and struggles facing us right now are, and what a different and better resolution of those conflicts might be.
Yeah. I mean, is there any point of, I guess not as a grand strategy question, but even so, even just as a point of interest, is there any of those particular pressure points that you think is the most promising or the most interesting or the most compelling or no?
I think it moves sort of over, you know, what we've seen in recent years, certainly since 2008 and the crisis, is this sort of like movement from sort of place to place, right? Yeah. In terms of what movements, you know, you have Occupy bringing the inequality question to the forefront, and you have Black Lives Matter, which is like really pushing on the kind of violence and militarization and dehumanization part of it, you know, and then you have Bernie, who is the sort of like, yeah, let's save and strengthen social democracy kind of thing, and it remains to be seen what the sort of next iteration of that is under, you know, what looks to be, you know, a Hillary Clinton administration, where we'll have probably, I would say, more of the same, but with a bit more war. And we're going to have to react to that in some ways.
Right. Well, Peter Fraze, the book is called The Four Futures, Life After Capitalism. I strongly recommend it to anyone sort of trying to get a grip on today's world and what's coming next. And also, you, my co-host on Two Dope Boys is a major Star Trek fan, and after I read your book, I finally went into Netflix and I tried to get through a couple of Next Generation episodes, and fascinating, but a little rough. Not gonna lie.
Start in season one. That's the first piece of advice.
Whew, well, I wish I had that advice before, Peter. Where should I start?
Skip to season three at least. That's okay. When they started to really know what they were doing.
Okay, because it's a little. It's stripping away the Patrick Stewart romanticism at this point. Okay, I appreciate that, man. I'm going to give season three a try. Peter Fraze, get the book. There's a link to it on the Majority.fm website. Author of The Four Futures, editor at The Jackman. Peter, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.
All right, folks, there you have it. Admit Jamie and Matt Bender. Hope you enjoyed that interview. I think it's a useful way of thinking about the future. Like, a lot of these things aren't determined. There's a lot of different variables, but the variables kind of work in certain directions. And hey, Matt and Jamie.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good. I agree. I think, you know, if you try to dig too much into the details of these four futures, that's where it starts to break down a little bit. But I think as a thought experiment, it's really fascinating. But should also be paired with stuff like, I'm going to say the work of Aaron Bonanov, who has a really different vision for the likelihood that full automation is ever going to come to pass.
Right.
What's up, guys? Can you hear me?
Hey, Matt, we can.
Perfect. Yeah. How about that Hillary Clinton administration, huh?
Oh, yeah. Jeez. I always think about
she's
that.
Just brutal with all this war right now. You know, it's I can't take her anymore. We got to vote her out.
I still remember like thinking it was I thought it was likely that Hillary was going to be president, thinking what those years were going to be like. And I still think it would have been a lot more pleasant than these 4 years.
I agree.
I mean, we'll definitely never know. Yeah. I was going to say we'll probably never know, but no, we won't.
You know what's going to happen if Biden wins. Biden will win, and then he'll resign, which means Kamala Harris will become president. And then Kamala Harris will then come out and say, no, the rightful first female president ever in the history of the U.S. is Hillary Clinton. And so I'm passing the baton to her.
Oh my God.
And, you know, that's how – I'm sure that's what's still – hashtag still with her think. But I agree with them. I think that's how it's going to go.
So what should we get to before we go to the fun half, guys?
You don't want to keep talking about this imaginary Hillary Clinton administration?
No, honestly, I can only tolerate so much Clinton talk before I want to you know, go after every single one of them, including Chelsea, for their relationship with terrible people. But so let's move on to a different topic. What should we get to?
Oh, yeah. Well, we have a wonderful clip from our president.
Oh, right.
Yeah, the one who actually won, right. Yeah, the guy whose administration we're currently living under. Correct, yes.
So... Yeah, I guess people have been a little concerned about what's going to happen with this election, considering all the mail-in ballots and the efforts by the Trump administration to delegitimize mail-in voting, stop the actual mail from getting where it needs to go, etc. So at a press conference, they decided to ask him about some of these concerns, and this is what our president said.
Win, lose, or draw in this election, will you commit here today for a peaceful transferal of power after the election? And there has been rioting in Louisville. There's been rioting in many cities across this country, red and your so-called red and blue states. Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transferal of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
People are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transferal of power?
We want to get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation. The ballots are out of control. You know it. And you know who knows it better than anybody else? The Democrats know it better than anybody else. Go ahead.
The second question is, will you please go ahead.
Listen, just, you know, you just cancel the election and everything will go great. That's pretty much, you know, the equivalent of what he's saying.
You cancel the mail-in ballots, which is, you know, to be fair, only part of the election, Matt. And then Trump thinks that he's going to win. And, you know, polls show that the people who vote in person are more likely to vote for Trump than the people who vote by ballots. So he understands that, and he thinks that he will win if they stop the ballots, and then he wins. And it's just a continuation, and that's the only way that he's not going to contest it.
Right. And you also have to give a little context as to why there's more Trump support probably going to vote in person than via mail-in ballots. And that's because Trump supporters don't really believe in that little what's going on right now. I'm trying to remember the sort of thing that just sort of upended the entire year and changed pretty much the course of how we'll live as a society for, I don't know, at least a few more years. The coronavirus pandemic, that thing. Yeah, they don't believe in that. So they'll probably go out. They're more likely to go out on election day and actually cast their ballot in person.
Well, even before the coronavirus, like mail-in ballots always typically favor the Democrats a little bit. I mean, there's all these recent elections that they've been, what's going on after all the ballots are counted? It turns out the Democrat won where it looked like the Republican did. And that's
It's funny too, because that goes completely against their usual thing that they say on election day, where it's like, oh yeah, our guy is losing until everyone else gets out of work, and then our people go and vote because they're all the ones working. I mean, clearly the people, that's the thing that they love to say. They love to pretend their voters are the ones who have jobs and can't vote until late at night when they get out of work.
I think we can solve that easily just making it a holiday.
Mm-hmm. Right, there you go, right.
Yeah, they're not going to do that. But luckily, we have this great opposition party led by Nancy Pelosi, first of her name, eater of ice cream, bringer of clapbacks, and she has another thing to tell them.
He says that people swallow Clorox and we hear about it for the rest of our lives, but he's trying to have the Constitution of the United States swallow Clorox, and I appreciate these questions that all of you have this morning, and I guess provoked by the arrogance and the disregard for the Constitution with the president's statement last night.
No, she didn't. Yo, she wasn't my she was my Khaleesi before, but now she is times 100. And I know that you believe that sincerely, Matt. So what do you think about this amazing clip of your queen?
Well, I got to jump on my white horse and Jorah Mormont myself over to to protect Miss Pelosi. It's corny. That's all. I mean, there's nothing really to defend. I think maybe it's not that big of a deal what she said, because it's just, you know, your normie cornballness. But yeah, I mean, it's weak. It's weak.
What stops them from being able to do this won't be the personal leadership qualities of Nancy Pelosi. It'll be basically it'll be too big of a hurdle for the GOP to actually jump. And particularly if Trump doesn't have a massive lead on the first night, like, I think it will be a bit, frankly, like, I've been wondering about this, right? Like, they want to get this judge seated, but, like, it's also the case that, I don't know, like, having that judge seated, I could see there be part of the Republican Party that is, okay, we got the judiciary wrapped up. Let's not, like, break this thing, because we frankly got a whole bunch of goodies out of this one Trump administration, and Joe Biden isn't going to be as big of a threat to us as, like, you know, Bernie Sanders, obviously. So, like, why would we really want to go this far? And I mean, they went that far in 2000, and I think they, like, I think the threat of them is real, to actually, like, try to steal this with the courts, because that's how the Republicans win elections. And like, Michael Tracy can say, oh, there's not going to be a civil war. Like, that's not the point. Yeah. That's not the point at all. The point is that these judges are going to give the election to the Republicans, you moron.
Yeah. Right. No, they don't.
I
mean,
I think you're giving, right. I think you're giving a little bit too much strategic credit to the Republican Party in terms of thinking that out. You know, they're going to want to control as much as they can control regardless. So I think they will go full bore, full throttle, and try to steal whatever they can. I mean, clearly the Supreme Court is the main prize. They'll be happy with that. I mean, they're going to get it. I guess the question is, will they try to get it before the election, or will they get it after? That's where their strategic mind will focus on. I think, you know, whatever happens with Trump in the election, I think that's where they'll just throw that all in the air and say, you know, screw it. We're going full steam ahead, and we're going to take it, try to take it all, whether we win it all or not. You know, we got the Supreme Court seat. We're winners no matter what. So why, you know, why play it safe when we could just shoot for the stars, knowing we've already, you know, we've already hit the one we were trying to aim for.
Yeah. And spoiler alert, they're going to seat the judge before the election. There's nothing that the Democrats are going to do about it. There are only a few things that the Democrats can do about it. And then when they have a supermajority on the Supreme Court and the election goes to the courts, how do you think they're going to decide? You know what? Maybe we should play this next clip from Lindsey Graham. Or should we save it? He's talking about the courts.
We can play it.
All right. Well,
for November 3rd, because of the tightness of the election and the role the Supreme Court could play, what are the odds of that happening?
My goal is to get the nominee through the committee process with a meaningful hearing, a probing hearing, get it to the floor in time for Mitch McConnell to process the nomination, get a final vote before the election. A 4-4 Supreme Court is not a good deal for America. We need a 9-person Supreme Court. And people wonder about the peaceful transfer of power. I can assure you it will be peaceful. Now, we may have litigation about who won the election, but the court will decide, and if the Republicans lose, we will accept that result. But we need a full court, and I think that's possible before the election. The committee will do its work. We'll be thorough, we'll be fair, but we'll be firm.
All right. Senator.
See, I don't think we need a full court. I think we could leave it open very easily and have a 4-4 court and just defer to the fucking ballots being counted.
Right.
That's the way I would have this election decided, to just make sure we count all the ballots.
Right. I don't think people understand, actually, you know, just how dangerous just what he's saying is. The Supreme Court, period, whether it's one judge, 9 judges, 8 judges, doesn't matter. They're irrelevant in this. They should not be involved in this. There is nothing that says they must certify this. The ballots are counted and the election results stand. There's nothing that says it has to go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And that's what they're floating here. They're floating that the results, no matter, even if Biden takes it away, complete lead, 10 points, they're going to try to take it to the court. And they think, or they're trying to make you all think, that that is a necessity. It's part of the process. It is not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is no scenario in which they do not take it to the courts, except for a Trump landslide, which we know is probably not going to happen. And he's getting everyone ready in this clip. He's saying this is going to the courts no matter what. And he's talking about it as if that is the reality. And that, guess what? That's how you impose your reality on the world, because everyone's got a competing version.
There was only 8 last time, right? My crazy.
Yeah, no, that's right. And it was for 200 plus days that they held that.
Yeah.
You don't need 9 justices at all.
Yeah.
You should. You don't need any justices for an election right. when people like, are actually allowed to vote and they're allowed to count the votes after the fact. But I mean,
not that hypocrisy is the key point here, but if their argument mattered, then that would have been an argument for seating Merrick Garland in 2016.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, nobody cares. I mean, everyone knows the Republicans are hypocrites. Nobody who would ever vote for one of them cares at all about hypocrisy. Okay. Like, remember the Daily Show? Remember the daily cavalcade of Republican hypocrisy that unmasked back in the Bush years? And everyone's like, wow, they really got him now. And it did what exactly?
Yeah, you do not have to. I've had plenty of disagreements with Jimmy Rieferkake about the efficacy of hypocrisy. That's not why I think it's relevant for a journalist to bring it up. Is like, I don't think it's going to change minds, but I think you can't just let, like, if you're a major news company, like these Sunday shows or whatever, like, these are basic facts that like are within like a cat's memory span.
Yeah, I mean, right.
you got to bring it up, but it's not gonna affect the people that you think
good,
it's going
like,
to affect.
To speak it into the record for posterity, but I don't think it's going to shift any votes in the election. Right. I read, speaking of voting, I read an article in the Atlantic that was extremely liberal. Like, it ended with exhortations to the cops to like protect voting rights, lol. But it went through all of these possible nightmare scenarios where Trump refuses to leave office based on like different results, what kind of crisis could result. It's not going to get to the point of a constitutional crisis. Is there anybody watching right now who thinks the Democrats are not going to roll over and let Trump have it way, 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 way before it even gets to that point?
I think it's wrong to think of this as a foregone conclusion that if they want to do a lawfare coup, they can. Like, I think there's a lot of states and state courts that have to be involved and run over here. Like, I think it's way overly fatalistic to just assume that just because Republicans want to do something, they can. Like, I think that's a step too far, personally.
I mean, I'm personal. Go ahead, Jim.
It's not a question of whether or not they can. It's a question of whether or not the Democrats are going to stop them. And if history is any indication, the answer is no.
I think they'll do something. I don't think, I mean, whether they take it as far as they should, that's one thing. But they definitely won't just let him take it from the get-go, you know.
They'll try it in some weak way.
This one's a bit different, I think, especially if it's a clear win, because you have to remember
it's not going to be clear, though. There's no way it's going to be clear.
But Republicans aren't talking about like hanging chads and things like that, where there actually will be questions. They're going to bring up that the ballots, the mail-in ballots, are just illegitimate, period. Like, that's going to be where they attack. And that's going to be something, like, there's going to be no question about unless it is an actual close result, which maybe it is, but I also think there's a good chance it isn't that close. When I mean close,
if we keep talking about it being a foregone conclusion that the Republicans are going to steal it, it might be closer than we want it to, which is why I think we should avoid talking like that, personally.
Yes, which is why I think it's really dangerous. Right. I mean, because they're going to go and do it anyway. Like, no matter what happens.
I mean, look.
Which is why it's important that Biden obviously wins by as much as possible.
If it is a landslide for Biden, it will be much harder for them to challenge the results of the election, for sure.
Right, but they're going to do it.
If he wins by a decent margin, I think it is. Like, I don't even think it needs to be a landslide. I think, like, if he wins in like certain specific states by enough, I think their whole plan gets upended. But
well, they're already doing the hanging chad thing with those envelopes in Pennsylvania. I mean,
right.
They're definitely going for it.
Going to try to throw out as many ballots as they can. I don't know. This article, I should link to it. It's full of lib shit, but it's actually pretty good and interesting. But like, Joe Biden actually commented on what he will do if Trump refuses to leave office after Biden wins. And he's like, well, I'm not worried about that. All the military will escort him out of there or whatever. The point is, they're not going to let Biden win in the first place. They're going to muddy the waters and make sure the results are as unclear as possible. And they're also, they're getting ready to pull some funny business with the electors too. Like, they
right, yeah, I saw that.
People
right.
from the Trump campaign off the right. record who were like, yeah, in a normal year, the electors are just this weird archaic thing that is predetermined by the results of the vote. But actually, none of that is fully enshrined in law. A lot of this is just based on custom, apparently. And in states where the Republicans control government, they can pick their own electors. And then guess who gets to decide which electors' envelopes open? Mike Pence. Hmm.
Yeah, what a strong foundation this country is built on. I mean, right.
Of course, but
really set this place up right.
Yeah, let's get to the fun half, actually. Oh, you guys got plugs?
Oh, yeah.
Well, first, I'm going to plug my eventual Jill Stein-esque recount fundraiser that I'm going to clearly set up because it's all headed in that direction. But anyway, until that happens, tonight on my live stream at youtube.com/MattBinder, 9:30 p.m. We will be live with Devin Burkhart of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights to basically take a dive into this report his organization has put out on the Groiper movement. This is the group that's pretty much led by the white supremacist Nick Fuentes. And they consider Michelle Malkin to be their mommy figure. Yes, that's what they call her, their mom. They sort of have been very undercovered these past couple of years. They didn't get the attention that the alt-right did. They're not getting the attention QAnon did. But I still think, especially as we approach the election, it's important to cover all these groups. And tonight we'll be talking about them. They're probably, they might be the one group of people who dislike Ben Shapiro more than the left. So it'll be interesting to dive into their mindset. YouTube.com/MattBinder. Subscribe there. Also Patreon.com/MattBinder to support the show monetarily if you can.
Jamie?
Hell yeah. So this week on the Antifada, we spoke with Aaron Thorpe, a.k.a. Posadist Trap God on Twitter, former host of Vanguard Army and host of the upcoming podcast, A Time of Monsters, which is very aptly named, I think, for the times we're living in. We talked about all sorts of things with him, the notorious RBG, how much the left should care about the courts and the SCOTUS. He had some harsh words for Killer Mike and the Black Miss Leadership class of Atlanta. And we also touched on all these white people pretending to be black for clout. And what's up with that? So patreon.com/theantifada. That's out now. Also, tomorrow I have a new episode of Vampire Castle with Leslie Lee III from Struggle Session, in which we talk about two vampire movies set in the workplace, one of which is Bloodsucking Bastards, and one of which is Vampire's Kiss, starring Nicolas Cage, which, as it turns out, your dad, Matt Binder, is a big fan of.
I just know that from, there's a still of Nick Cage looking like this. Yeah. That's very famous from that movie.
It's such a bad movie. Like Leslie said it best, I think, like, what if American Psycho were a terrible, terrible movie? That's what this movie would be. But it's a cult classic, and I could see why, because Nicolas Cage is very over the top in it.
I mean, that's pretty much every Nick Cage movie, but yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes it works, sometimes it don't. Mandy is a recent Nick Cage movie that I enjoyed, actually.
Yeah.
I have to see that one. I've heard good things
about
that.
That movie's great. We talked about it on the Antifada, on our Gothic Marxism episode.
Oh, wow.
Someone described Nick Cage as the best actor and also the worst actor, depending on who's directing him.
I mean, you want the superlatives. If you got both the superlatives, people are going to remember you.
That's range.
Yeah. On Tuesday night on TMBS, we had Marshall Steinbaum, I always want to say a Utah professor of economics, but a economics professor at Utah University, University of Utah, on to talk about the gig economy and labor law at large and how we classify people as employees and not, and how a Harvard Law proposal of sectoral bargaining might be a way that the Democrats sell out the gig economy workers and everybody who's not getting full employment benefits. So look, it's a bit wonky of an episode, but I think we did a pretty good job. And Marshall's, I mean, one of the smartest guys on the economic left on Twitter. So Check that out, patreon.com/TMBS. And I will probably hit the skies in Flight Simulator at twitch.tv/literary hangover in the next 2 or 3 days. And we'll see you in the fun house.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. Great, horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.